Ed Senny. I teach in the Department of Theology at Valparaiso University. Those of you who've been at one of my sessions before have heard that before, but the tape hasn't heard it. This particular tape has to hear that. I teach in the theology department there, mostly working in world religions, and that's what I've been doing at Holden last week. And then this week, as you know, I'm focusing on Native American things. Especially for the benefit of those who were in the session yesterday, I think I better pick something up that I didn't take time to do in that session. The very last point on my outline yesterday was something about the sacredness of the land and the meaning of the landscape to Native American peoples. It's something that we, I think, have a hard time understanding, because I guess our ancestors who came over from Europe, and for some of us that's not too many generations back maybe, already came over with the understanding of land ownership. And somehow, in this land, people had the idea that the land was quite empty of people, and it was unused, and it seemed all the more an invitation to come and make the land over to ourselves and take it and use it. And after all, God gave the land to us to be used. And so the whole business of moving out and taking ownership of land, and in that process, I suppose it is safe to say that the Native American peoples lost their land. Now, part of the problem for them was that they didn't understand what this business of really owning land meant. They may have heard the words, they may have signed the papers or marked them or whatever they did, but they didn't understand it really. How can you own the land when the land is our mother? And the land can't belong to us. We belong to the land. Now, if you take those two very opposite viewpoints, the really deep understanding that we are the people of our mother, the earth, as opposed to the notion that land is to be possessed, land is real estate, land is to be developed, and things like that. What a clash in worldviews that was. And it was out of that clash that an awful lot of the bitterness that goes on to this very day was created. For Native American peoples, space and the landscape were ways in which they knew the meaning and structure of their lives, the way they knew the sacred, the way they knew God at work, the gods, the spirits at work in this world. For the divine powers, whether they are thought to be many or whether they are thought to be one represented in many places, either way, they are anchored in the landscape. In that mountain peak, there is power. In that stream, and the origin of that stream, is the goddess. At the bottom of this lake is a divine power. And here, and there, and in the landscape that they knew, that they woke up and saw every day, there were the familiar spirits, gods, goddesses, and powers that made their life meaningful and coherent. And so to say, excuse me, please, I know that you've lived here a while, but let's move you on over to here so we can have this. And after all, this place over here is just as fine. Well, you've just taken them out of a world that had meaning and order and structure, holiness, safety, security, and you've put them in a place that doesn't make any sense to them. There's not a one story that tells about the holiness of the new place that they've been put, and so the demoralization. They were even told, now, we know you've been hunting a long time, but I'll tell you what, we can teach you in 3 easy lessons how to become farmers. And so they try it. And it's depressing. It works, but it doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean anything, because we are the people of the bow. And other people may be the people of the hoe, but we are the people of the bow. The bow and the arrow. We are hunters. They are the farmers, not we. So, you see, the land and the landscape are a source of meaning and order and structure. And as soon as that is disturbed, then the meaningfulness of life is stripped away. And for that reason, of course, there is a lot of cultural depression and sorrow and confusion about what to do. That's the end of yesterday's lecture. But it comes in over and over, no matter when we talk, where we pick up the story about Native Americans and the meanings that they have in their life. Today, I want to begin talking about some things in the Plains Indian traditions, but quite frankly, I'm going to focus directly on the Black Elk tradition. Quite a few of you, I suppose, have read some of the Black Elk material. Can I get some idea how many of you are acquainted with the Black Elk material? Only a few, it seems like. There are a number of things. I don't have them all with me right now, but one of the very well-known ones, and one of the earliest ones, is this little piece called The Sacred Pipe. And it is put together by Joseph Epps Brown, a historian of religions from the University of Montana, I'm pretty sure it is. And he recorded these sessions with an old Sioux, Oglala, a holy man called Black Elk, and has put them together nicely to tell the story about what they believed. And in this particular book, he deals with the 7 rites, the 7 ceremonies of the Oglala Sioux, the 7 primary ceremonies. And that's what I'm going to focus on mostly. Another piece that was done on Black Elk was Neihardt's, I believe that's the way you say his name, John. And he did one called Black Elk Speaks. And that tells about the vision that Black Elk received in his youth, and which he then hoped and prayed and struggled to work out in the course of his lifetime. That's a beautiful book for trying to understand this whole tradition. So we're focusing on some Sioux people, the Lakota people, in South Dakota. By focusing on the Black Elk tradition. Just a few days ago, a surprise to me, I discovered this book in the bookstore over here. I think I may have gotten the second last copy. It's called Keepers of the Fire, Journey to the Tree of Life, based on Black Elk's vision. And it's a beautiful little book of illustrations and big print text just describing the journey for the tree of life, and the vision that the people of the world might live in balance and harmony. It's a lovely little book, and it's put together like a child's book, I guess. Maybe that's why I like it. So pass it around if you want to. That'd be fun. And then a while back, I suppose a year or two ago, I got acquainted with this book, fairly recent one, about an 82 thing, I believe, maybe a little more recent than that, called The Gift of the Sacred Pipe. And here in this book, Vera Louise Drysdale has edited the text of The Sacred Pipe, mostly shortened it, and put it together pretty nicely. And then she's an artist, and she created illustrations, some colored illustrations and some black and white pencil illustrations. And I cried a lot when I read it, because for joy that she had caught, I think, the spiritual quality of those seven rites of the Oglala Sioux. She's illustrating those. And so that I could share it with other people, I tell you about the book and tell you, please, if you got a lot of money and like things like this, buy it. They don't have any here because I just told them about it yesterday. But somewhere you may wish to look for this book, The Gift of the Sacred Pipe by Vera Louise Drysdale. The reason I'm so anxious for somebody to make sales on that is because I had some slides made of her illustrations so that I could show them to you. That makes me just a little worried to take slides of her illustrations without her permission. So buy it sometime. The Black Elk Tradition. I've showed you a couple of the books. Who was Black Elk? Well, he is from the Oglala Sioux tradition, tribe, they say. Now, what is this whole Oglala Sioux thing? We have a very large number of people who fit under the name Dakota. The Dakota are an alliance of friends, literally an alliance of friends. And they came to be called the Sioux because something like Nadewisu was the name given them by the Ojibwa people or the Chippewa people up there in Minnesota, where they shared some space. And that name meant snake in the grass or something like that, treacherous snake. So they, the Ojibwa and the Dakota were at odds. They were warring neighbors. And the Chippewa had the upper hand usually. And they named them treacherous snakes. And so the French heard that and passed it on. And that's how come this whole people has gone under the name Sioux. Or at least that's a shortened explanation of that. But they would call themselves Dakota, Alliance of Friends. Then the subdivisions of that go on quickly to be first three, and then that subdivides. So we talk about the seven council fires of the Dakota. And one of those is called Lakota, the Lakota. And in parenthesis, whenever we see this diagrammed in their books, we see Teton. The Teton Sioux is what they would be popularly called, or the Teton Dakota, or the Lakota, as they probably would call themselves most of the time. The word Teton meant plains dwellers, and it was given to this particular, to the Lakota people, as they were being pushed out of Minnesota by their enemies, the Chippewa, and they crossed the Missouri and went into the plains. And so they are people of the plains, and that is Teton. That happened around 1760. So you see how important it is to, when you see a map, to say, well, when were they here? They weren't in this region where they now are. They were farmers. They were farmers up there in Minnesota. And they became buffalo hunters. And sometime after 1760, they got the horses in this part of the country and began to ride those horses. And pretty soon we get the picture of the feathered bonnets and the horses and the bow and arrow and the buffalo herds and that. But that all is a result of a cultural change from the time that they came out of Minnesota. Which tells us something I was suggesting again yesterday, that the peoples have always been changing. They have always been encountering things that have brought about changes of meaning and lifestyle for them. And this was certainly one of them. Now, the focus of our attention then will be on one of the divisions of the Teton Lakota people. So that people, the Lakota, is divided into seven divisions: Brule, Oglala, Humpapa, Minneconjou, Blackfeet, and not to be confused with the other linguistic Blackfoot group way up in northern Montana. But there's a Blackfoot group that's part of the Lakota too, and several more that I can't pronounce and I didn't have room for them on my page. There are seven divisions of the Tetons, and we're focusing on the Oglala Sioux. And they are the people who live primarily on the Pine Ridge Reservation in southwestern South Dakota. And it is on that reservation where we have had the Wounded Knee Massacre, and we've had a number of other fairly hostile encounters, not so far back in our memory. Now, one of the important things that we know these people for is the buffalo and their relationship to the buffalo. For the buffalo have become the source of meaning in their life and the primary symbol for them. I discover as I study tribal religions throughout the world and try to go back into the most primal possible moments that you can try to understand, at least, I conclude, not I, but scholars of that kind of material make it quite clear that that the religious symbols emerge where people's food supply is, where they get their food. There, something holy is going on. Something sacred is going on. And so we find that if they are hunting people, the animals that provide the primary source of their food supply are holy to them. And it's as though, we don't need much light for what little I'm going to put up here. It's as though we have, I'll use the shortest word, God, buffalo, humans, and the life is flowing. It comes from somewhere. The buffalo are their life, and they don't take for granted. Nice that the buffalo are here, aren't we lucky? But they see the buffalo as a precious gift. Every day, the gift that gives them life. There is a poem, and I just popped into my mind that I can't either recite or tell you the name of the author right now, an Indian author, but it's about the celebration of being alive. I am alive, I am alive, I am alive, and I stand in good relation to all that is alive. That's that sort of idea. And that seems so typical to me of traditional peoples. They refuse to take it for granted that there is life. Life is the mystery. The greatest mystery of all, that there should be life and that it should keep on coming. It's channeled to us. Something has to give up its life in order that we might have life. And this is not for the Oglala. This is not simply biological life, nice to have buffalo meat to eat, but it's the whole cultural life of the people, for the hides and all the things those are used for the bones and the tools that are made of that, for the intestines and certain parts of that are used for certain purposes, to make bags out of and so forth. Just anything and everything, even the waste matter of the buffalo chips, you know, become fuel for the fire, a sacred fuel for the fire, for cooking and for keeping warm and all of such things. So the buffalo are both the biological and the cultural life of the people, and that elicits gratitude, a religious response. There must be behind such a gift, the gift of life, a giver somehow. And it seems to me that out of that kind of realization, that kind of response, we get the makings of religion and the fundamental symbols of the religion. So we will see these people in particular are paying an enormous amount of attention to these buffalo. And I'm ready to have the slide projector on now and to start sharing some of those. I can get it probably quick. Now, we're going to need to dim lights to make it look nicer. Any of those others that need to be off. That one up there might be the worst. That's pretty good, isn't it? We get that one off. That one won't. That's the one that's going to bother us the most. Thank you. That'll be nice. Now I can't see. Let's see. I'm going to have to see, to tell you the truth, because I made a plan to read some text to you from the edited version here, and in fact I could just talk about this, but it has been stated so beautifully and with such detail that I think you need to feel the religious response that I feel like I need to take a lot of what I want to say from the text here. Okay. Early one morning, very many winters ago, two Lakota were out hunting with their bows and arrows. As they were standing on a hill looking for game, they saw in the distance something coming towards them in a very strange and wonderful manner. When this mysterious thing came nearer, they saw it was a very beautiful woman dressed in white buckskin, bearing a bundle on her back. Now this woman was so good to look at that one of the Lakota had bad intentions. Not noble savages after all, huh? Had bad intentions and told his friend, that's getting better on light there, about his desire. But this good man said he must not have such thoughts, for surely this is a Wakan, or holy. Wakan is holy, full of holy power. Holy woman. The mysterious woman was now very close, and putting down her bundle, she asked the one with bad intentions to come over to her. As the young man approached her, they were both suddenly covered by a great cloud. When it lifted, the sacred woman was standing there, and at her feet was the man with the bad thoughts, who was now nothing but bones. "Behold what you see," the strange woman said to the good man. "I am coming to your people, and wish to talk with your chief, Standing Hollow Horn. Return to him and tell him to prepare a large teepee in which he should gather all his people. I wish to tell them something of great importance." The young man returned to the teepee of his chief and told him all that had happened. The chief, Standing Hollow Horn, then had a great lodge prepared, as the sacred woman had instructed. He sent out a crier to tell the people to put on their best buckskin clothes and to gather immediately in the lodge. The people were, of course, all very excited as they waited in the great lodge for the coming of the holy woman. Everybody was wondering where she came from and what it was that she wished to say. Soon the young men who were watching for her coming announced that they saw something in the distance approaching in a beautiful manner. And then suddenly the holy woman entered the lodge, walked around sunwise, that is, clockwise, and stood in front of Chief Standing Hollow Horn. Standing Hollow Horn. She took from her back the bundle, and holding it with both hands in front of her, she said, "Behold this, and always love it. It is very sacred. No impure person should be allowed to see it, for within this bundle there is a sacred pipe. With this pipe, you will, during the winters to come, send your voices to Wakantanka, the Great Spirit. who is your father and grandfather. After the mysterious woman said this, she took from the bundle a pipe and also a small round stone, which she placed upon the ground. Holding the pipe up with its stem to the heavens, she said, "With this sacred pipe, you will walk upon the earth. For the earth is your grandmother and mother, and she is very sacred. Every step that is taken upon her should be as a prayer. The bowl of this pipe is of red stone. It is the earth." Pipestone, Minnesota. Red dirt, red clay. There's another story not told in this particular passage about how some of their ancestors had been massacred in that place. And so when all the blood of their ancestors soaked into that ground, that made the red clay. And so the holiest clay of all for making the sacred pipe is from pipestone. And it is that beautiful red stone. It is the earth, carved in the... I'll make it up. Carved in the stone and facing the center is this buffalo calf, who represents all the four-legged ones who live upon your mother. That is on the stem of the pipe, just behind the bowl of the pipe, still in the red stone clay, is the image of a buffalo facing the center, which I believe means facing the smoker. So the smoker is eyeball to eyeball with the buffalo. The ones you see in the tourist shops often have the buffalo looking the other way. And I think that's not correct. "And these 12 feathers which hang where the stem fits into the bowl are from the spotted eagle. They represent the eagle and all the winged ones of the air. All these peoples and all the things of the universe are joined to you who smoke the pipe." Get that statement again. "All of these things in the universe are joined to you who smoke the pipe. All send their voices to Wakantanka, the Great Spirit, with you. When you pray with this pipe, you pray for and with everything." The Wakan woman then touched the foot of the pipe to the round stone which lay upon the ground, and she said, "With this pipe you will be bound to all your relatives, your grandfather and father, your grandmother and mother. This round rock, which is of the same red stone as the bowl of the pipe, your father Wakantanka has also given to you. It represents the earth, your grandmother and mother, where you will live and increase. All of this is sacred, so do not forget. Every dawn is a holy event, and every day is holy, for the light comes from your father, Wakantanka. You must always remember that the two-legged ones and all the other peoples who stand upon this earth are sacred and should be treated as such. These seven circles which you see on the stone have much meaning, for they represent the seven rites which in time will be revealed to you, in which the pipe will be used. Standing hollow-horned, be good to these gifts and to your people, for they are Wakan. With this pipe the two-leggeds will increase, and there will come to them all that is good. From above, Wakantanka has given to you this sacred pipe so that through it you may have knowledge. For this great gift, you should always be grateful." The sacred woman completed the instructions for another rite. I skipped a couple paragraphs because there's a short description of the keeping and releasing of the soul, and it wouldn't make sense unless I spend a lot of time on it, so I'm going to skip that and let her go away now. Then she rose and started to leave the lodge. But turning again to Standing Hollow Horn and the people, she said, "Behold this pipe. Always remember how sacred it is and treat it as such, for it will take you to the end. Remember, in me there are four ages. I am leaving now, but I shall look back upon your people in every age, and at the end I shall return. The buffalo speaking, huh? Buffalo calf woman. Moving around the lodge in a sunwise manner, the mysterious woman left. But after walking a short distance, she looked back towards the people and sat down. When she rose, the people were amazed to see that she had become a young red and brown buffalo calf. So the woman becomes a buffalo calf. Then this calf walked further, lay down, and rolled, looking back at the people. And when she got up, she was a white buffalo. Again, the white buffalo walked further and rolled on the ground, becoming now a black buffalo. This buffalo then walked still farther away from the people, stopped, and after bowing to each of the four quarters of the universe, disappeared over the hill. That is the story of white buffalo calf woman and the gift of the sacred pipe. And the clues are there for us. What this sacred pipe means, and how these people understand their relationship to all the things in the creation. How that pipe is actually becomes an image of the universe, and to smoke it is to put yourself in harmony with all those things in the universe, the wigan, the plant life in the stem, the Mother Earth, in the carved bowl, to put yourself in harmony with all of creation, so that with one voice, the whole creation now, through you, can offer prayer to the Great Spirit. That's, in short, what it means. Now, Black Elk said something interesting about this matter of God coming to the people in the form of buffalo, and then a buffalo woman. You got that, didn't you? That since the buffalo are so sacred, of course, they can become the woman, and then in that way communicate with the people. And then she returns to the buffalo realm once more by becoming a buffalo and bowing to the four quarters and going over the hill. Which then finally, as she goes away, says the same source of this sacred gift, the sacred gift from the sacred source, this same one is in fact the buffalo. For she returns to become one of the buffalo, doesn't she? So the buffalo are the channel for this. Black Elk puzzled about this matter as to the objection that Christians seem to have on this thing. They couldn't understand how anybody could be silly enough to believe that a God could in some way become incarnate in a buffalo, and then a buffalo calf woman. He said, "We have been told by the white men, or at least by those who are Christian, that God sent to men his Son, who would restore order and peace upon the earth. And we have been told that Jesus the Christ was crucified, but that he shall come again at the last judgment, the end of this world or cycle." This I understand and know that it is true. He better say that. He was a good Catholic. Know that? He was a good Catholic. But the white men should know that for the red people too, it was the will of Wakantanka, the Great Spirit, that an animal turn itself into a two-legged person in order to bring the most holy pipe to his people. And we too were taught that this white buffalo cow woman who brought our sacred pipe will appear again at the end of this world, a coming which we Indians know is now not very far off. Think about that. So what is the pipe, and what does it mean to smoke the pipe? To
smoke the pipe, in a sense, is a meditation. I would call it a meditation, especially as the smoker holds it. But usually it is used in a circle and passed around so that a circle of people, always circle, never squares, for circles are continuous and hold us together. And as the people smoke, they together are in an active meditation upon the sacredness of their relationship to each other and to all things, and thus, as each of them prays, they know they are all praying together, and the pipe is the gift that holds all that symbolism together. And of course, it's much more complex than we've given it, because in other places you get other details, but we can only deal with it at least, I think, this much. It helps us to get on the right track. So to smoke the pipe is a very holy activity. Would someone care to ask any questions or share anything you know about this matter with the group before I go on to talk about the other ceremony, the ceremony of purification in the sweat lodge? Yes?
I just wondered if they, when they smoke the pipe, do they, you know, is the smoke itself and really, you know, taking it in and kind of feeling it through this, you know, their way in, or do they just puff at it? You know, is it not very symbolic to really take in that smoke?
There is really no, I have not come across comment on that, as though it seems unimportant whether you inhale this or you don't inhale it, but you do puff on it. Mm-hmm. No one talks about inhaling it. I certainly don't understand what's going on here as a means for becoming intoxicated for the sake of religious ecstasy, as perhaps in the use of peyote or something like that. I don't see it connected with that, although some people sometimes comment.
I was more wondering if, you know, kind of almost that, I think I was imposing some of my whole symbolism of spirit and wind.
And taking it in.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And that ruach kind of thing.
Yeah, ruach, the spirit. Yeah, I don't know. I can't say for sure. But I think taking it into your body, whether you take it all the way down into your lungs or not, is probably
yeah, you said that about so then it, and vital. Then it going back out into, you know, take in the spirit of the whole universe, mm-hmm. And all that, and then, but maybe I was trying to read something, but
yeah.
It's not there.
I'm not going to be able to help you on that one. I don't think any further on that. Yes. I forget how to pronounce it. Kaniki. Yeah, who said that? Kinnick. Well, I don't know what that relation is to what we have called tobacco, but it is one of the things that they use a lot. Can you say anything further about that? Is it easily available? It will grow wild around out there?
It's a mixture of different things. It isn't just one particular type of material.
There is a plant that's called Kinnick.
Yeah, presumably that would be.
It's kind of a little vine.
Uh-huh.
It's real small leaves.
Uh-huh.
Something I would like, they don't speak while they're doing this ceremony, do they? Is it quiet?
Well, we're going to see in the sweat lodge in a minute that they do pray. They pray and they pray out loud.
Oh.
Yeah, as they pass it around, and they hold the pipe and offer their prayer. Smoke. Pass that around. Hold the pipe and offer prayer that way.
Do men and women take part in this ceremony?
To the best of my understanding from the things I've been able to look at, they do not together inside the sweat lodge.
But I mean the pipe?
Well, the pipe ceremonies go on in context, and the main context for them is in the sweat lodge. There are, I'm sure, other settings. And I, as far as I can tell, I do know that women participate in some of these rites, for instance, in the purification rite at the sweat lodge. They have their own preparations, and they even have their own vision quest, but they do it a little bit differently from the men. And I'm quite certain that they participate in the pipe ceremony in preparation for those events, at least. Yes?
Mentioned in the story about the buffalo bowing the four directions, that was something else that's done with the pipe, is offering the four directions each time.
Time and time and time again, as we will see in the sweat lodge ceremony, they're constantly dealing with the four directions and invoking the powers of the four directions with the pipe. All right, maybe we should move on to that. I see we're not going to finish what I had intended to, but that's because I get carried away reading. And that's a pretty text, though, isn't it? I mean, a nice statement about what this is. And I will be very tempted to do much of the same in a minute, because I want you to hear some of these prayers, these fantastic prayers that go along with this the building of the sweat lodge and so forth. Now, before we go further on this, however, I'll let you look at the pretty picture of the sweat lodge while I talk about this. In this past ceremony, and in the one I'm going to talk about next, you're constantly hearing about grandfather and father. Wakantanka as grandfather, Wakantanka as father. And there is a theology behind that that is kind of impressive, I think. The grandfather reference to Wakantanka is God in the unlimited and unqualified state. God apart from any manifestation of God. It's sort of I, being an old Tillichian fan, Paul Tillich fan, I have to go way back and say, it's sort of like talking of God, the very ground of all being. Maybe that's not. Then you have Wakantanka as father, and that always is in reference to God in relation to the creation and in acting as in relation to us and in relation to other aspects of the creation. So you always have this grandfather and father, and then also grandmother and mother, for the earth is created by Wakantanka, but it has become then grandmother and mother, the ground or substance of all being, of all growing things, the ground or substance of all growing things, the potentiality of all life forms, that's grandmother earth. Mother earth is the active producer of these things. So it's kind of the difference between potentiality and actuality, if you can deal with that sort of thing. But that's the language that moves through, as you heard in that last passage, grandfather and father, grandmother and mother. Now comes the building of the sweat lodge, which is the universe. Once again, the sweat lodge is the universe. And we got a lot of that kind of symbolism in the pipe itself, didn't we? Well, let's see if I can share some of this. The way he talks about this. The rite of the sweat lodge utilizes all the powers of the universe, earth and the things which grow from the earth, water, fire, air. The water represents the thunder beings, the thunderbirds of the great west, who come fearfully with great thunder and lightning, but they bring goodness. For the steam which comes from the rocks in the sweat lodge, within which is the fire, is frightening, but it purifies us so that we may live as Wakantanka wills. And he may even send to us a vision if we become very pure. When we use the water in the sweat lodge, we should think of Wakantanka, who is always flowing, giving his power and life to everything. Giving his power and life to everything. We should even be as water, which is lower than all things, yet stronger even than the rocks. So you get a little meditation on the meaning of water and how that might affect us and our character. The sweat lodge is made from 12 or 16 young willows, and these too have a lesson to teach us, for in the fall their leaves die and return to the earth, but in the spring they come to life again. So too, men die, but live again in the real world of Wakantanka, where there is nothing but the spirits of all things. And this true life we may know here on earth if we purify our bodies and minds, thus coming closer to Wakantanka, who is all purity. The willows which make the frame of the sweat lodge are set up in such a way that they mark the four quarters of the universe. Thus, the whole lodge is the universe in an image, and I mustn't read too much of this. The things that we will have here then in the lodge are the water that will be used to put on the rocks. Take yourself back to the sauna, and you know what a wet sauna anyway, and you know what they're talking about. That's the thunder beings, the life flowing from Wakantanka. Fire is Wakantanka's power, and it is the power that he uses to purify all things. And his fire is inside the rocks that are being brought in, the heated rocks. So Wakantanka is there in that form. The willow branches represent the world of plants, and especially the standing people, that is, the trees. They are the standing people. And they are, of course, arranged in the four quarters so as, again, to build a microcosm, an image of the total world. We always are related and connected to the total sacred creation. That's why this constant reference to the four directions. The rocks are grandmother earth, for they come deep from within her own body. The door is going to face east, the place where warmth and light, where the sun comes from. And there is a path, as we can't see too well on here, but there is a path from the open door to the little mound on which is leaning a pipe, the little mound of dirt, leaning pipe, and the fire. There's a path that is built, scraped in the ground, and it is the path of our life. It is the path of our life. Meditation then is on what sort of life, what sort of walk we are having. The eternal fire, it is called that, the eternal fire is that fire about 10 paces out from to the east from the door of the lodge. When we finish building the lodge then, we have those poles. Now there's a lot more to it than that. In the middle they dig a hole in the center. This could easily become a lodge here. They dig a hole in the center, taking that earth out and making the path of life out of it, and the mound, which is Mother Earth. And then it is covered with a holy cloth of symbols, and it becomes the leaning place for the sacred pipe when it's not being passed. And then it's in that little pit in the middle where Wakantanka is centered. And that is where the hot stones will be placed with forked sticks there brought in from that, handed in and placed in that. And the bucket of water, as you see it there, will be set nearby, and dippers of water will be placed on it. Also inside, on the floor, you will probably have it covered with sage and or sweet grass. And I've been wanting some of this sweet grass for so long, and I had to pay $4 for a silly braid of about 14 inches. But I wanted it so bad that I did that. Smell it. I won't burn any now because it's too expensive to burn. But they will cover the floor with that beautiful sweet grass and sage. And they sit on that, and they use the sweet grass to dip into the water and to flip the water onto the stones, and the scent of the sweet grass comes out with the mist then, the steam that rises. So the sage and the sweet grass are representative of the grasses of the gifts of Mother Earth again inside the lodge. They will hang feathers on the pipe. Well, we know about the feathers on the pipe, the eagle feathers, who represent, in one sense, all of the winged people of the universe,
but especially the high-flying ones, the ones that fly so close to God, the eagles. For they are special ways in which God's message comes down. If you go to an Indian event, and this happened to me, the very first powwow I went to down in Arizona, we were just walking in, we were glad we finally found this place. It was a football field is what it was, but they had this big ring of chairs making a great circle, and in the middle, the drummers were out there and the chanters. And there was an entrance into that circle. That was where the dancers would enter the circle. And there were two men that looked pretty senior to me and looked like they might know what it was all about. And as I was walking up and just trying to take in this whole situation, one of them looked up like that, and a big smile on his face, and his partner looked up following him, and a big smile on his face, and I looked up, and it was a hawk. A hawk flew right over their circle. And I didn't understand their reaction to that at that time, but didn't take long, I discovered that that was a blessing. That was a messenger of Wakantanka blessing the event at the beginning of that event. So the eagle feathers on the pipe bring that part of the universe in. And so the sweat lodge and the buffalo, don't forget the buffalo, they had to give up a lot of life in order to create the life of the sweat lodge, all those hides that make the airtight cover for the sweat lodge. I am going to now simply make a few summary statements. I think in this, you see the inside of the sweat lodge and the men sitting there in breechcloth on their sage with the rocks in the middle. Some people talk about should the rocks, the leader of the ceremony asks for red rocks or black rocks or not quite red rocks. You know, how hot should the rock be? You got to be pretty careful heating rocks. You better know what kind of rocks you're heating or they will explode. And that'd pretty well take care of everybody in the lodge if one of those would explode. So they have to know what kind of rocks to heat red hot like that and then pour water. They are there passing the stone in and you have the offering of the pipe. They will be saying prayers all the way through this process of building the sweat lodge, and always the prayers are about our harmony with the whole universe and our praying all together. And then when they crawl inside, when the participants crawl through the door to go into the sweat lodge, there is a standard little phrase that they repeat, and our translation of it is simply, all our relatives, all our relatives, which simply means everybody and everything in God's creation is related to us as personal relationship. So it's to seek that complete harmony with all those things. In the next slide, the artist did the job, I think, both of giving us the sense of the mist that fills the air inside, which as you breathe it, feels like it is burning holes through your lungs. It is painful in a lot of ways to breathe that hot. They really do make them hot, I understand. I have some testimonies about that. So it takes courage to see it through. And they break this ceremony up into four parts and open the door briefly between each part, and in some celebrations, they are even allowed to step out for a 5 or 10 minute break between the second and the third quarter, as they call them. Then go back in, and then you see what is expressed there? Hardly needs to be said that that's new life, new birth. All impurities of body and spirit have been taken away, have been given away in this purifying sweat lodge. And he comes out born again.
to receive the light of Wakantanka. Now, as we will begin, as we will see tomorrow, most of the uses of the sweat lodge are in preparation for other ceremonies. It can be used for its own sake and by itself, but it is especially important before the vision quest, before a sun dance, before certain other kinds of ceremonies. And I will show you some slides tomorrow about the vision quest and the sun dance. Maybe select a few prayers to share with you at that time. Are there things, I didn't do it right tonight on time because you don't have much time now, but if somebody has a question or a comment or two right now while we're still gathered together, that would be good, but we'll have to vacate pretty quickly here.
This ceremony was created since they became buffalo.
I'm not going to be able to tell you that. I'm not sure whether anybody quite knows. We know that a sweat lodge type ceremony has been known in many parts of the United States among Native Americans. And when the Dakota began to use it, I don't know. And I don't know that anyone does. But at least I haven't run across any suggestions about one. But many of its meanings, of course, are oriented to the buffalo in this case.
Do they still regularly use these ceremonies?
Yes, they do. And since 1978, when Native Americans received the legal right to practice their religion, 1978, they have made their claim to have a sweat lodge built in penitentiaries and prisons where Indian people are incarcerated. And it's been done. Not always by request, but if they fight hard enough legally, they can't stop them from doing it. It is the symbol of their religious practice.
It's interesting that the smoke in many religions is considered a cleansing kind of
a cleansing and a rising incense and that burning sweet grass or burning sage in some cases that. There's a lot of burning of this sweet grass and smoking the lodge up and so forth. Thank you very much for your attention and